Unpopular opinion, but
Unpopular opinion.
You're listening to Unpopular Opinion, a podcast for professionals from all walks of life who want to hear success stories from innovators who've won by taking the path less traveled. In each episode, recovering journalist and content marketer Ashley Amber Saba interviews individuals who have prospered thanks to their genuinely unpopular opinions, despite warnings from naysayers, threats to their careers, and colossal obstacles. All rebels are welcome.
Welcome to Unpopular Opinion. I'm your host, Ashley Saba, and this episode is brought to you by Audience Ops. Audience Ops is a done-for-you, content-led growth agency that offers content strategy, blog posts, case studies, and full-service podcast production for professionals looking to launch a podcast like this one. Today, I have with me LinkedIn's pickle at large, freelance executive ghostwriter, Michelle Hironaka. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashley. I'm excited.
I am too. I've talked to Michelle quite a bit in the past, and we have kind of a fun ongoing banter on our messages happening. We've met only one other time virtually, but hopefully one day we might be able to make that happen in actual life.
Oh, absolutely. You're on my Texas like bucket list now. Got to go meet Ashley.
Hey, you are the only one on my Utah bucket list.
Oh, that's an honor, because Utah is, I feel like we're overrepresented on LinkedIn, so I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah, you're at the top, and you're exclusive to me.
I feel so popular. Oh my gosh, you stop it.
Oh, well, I actually have Michelle on today because she has a unique take on leading with the awkward, which I love. But when it comes to new relationships and your content, you are totally cool with leading with the awkward. Can you kind of catch everybody up on that?
Yeah, I think it's the perfect way to really quickly identify your allies, but then, you know, you really just instill deep-seated fear with your enemies just off the bat. No, I mean, kind of, it's honestly what it is it's an immediate filter. It's kind of a self-protection mechanism that I've got going on now. And it's simultaneously a great way to like to showcase self-confidence, but then also that you don't take yourself too seriously. And it's the best foot forward with a new relationship, honestly, because the most honest thing that you can do is a surprised laugh. Because you're not checking what that sounds like. You're not, you know, thinking, you're just surprised and you laugh. And, you know, if you can start a relationship off, you know, that honest, that's a pretty beautiful thing. And so that's kind of all of the different logic behind that approach.
I love that. Can you kind of catch everybody up on your work history and your background and how that might tie in with that take?
Yeah, so actually my resume is full of a lot of different jobs. So I worked a lot of service and labor jobs at the beginning of my career when I first moved out. I moved out here for cheaper in-state tuition, but I was afraid of debt. So I worked, you know, these jobs like I was waitressing, I was a fry cook, I was a housekeeper, I was a secretary, I was a lot of different things. And a nanny at one point. And I just kind of didn't have the self-confidence that I would be able to get into marketing, which was ultimately my career goal without a college education. And all this time throughout all of this, you know, I was getting kind of this messaging that I needed to be something I currently wasn't, that my personality was too much. I'm pretty loud. I'm kind of a big personality, and you know, that'll get you far in waitressing. And as a nanny, I'm freaking awesome. But you know, as a secretary or as these different roles that I was in, you know, it wasn't appreciated and it was seen as like unneeded. And so I was slowly getting this messaging that you can only be adorkable if you're Zooey Deschanel, if you're a manic pixie dream girl, but keep the rest of that goofiness quiet, because we want our young ladies hardworking and elegant. And then I got some great advice for my career and overall from my now father-in-law, but then my boyfriend's dad, to go after a job I wanted, whether or not I was qualified. Best advice I ever got. I got into a sales position in marketing. And from there, that messaging continued. And in fact, it was probably a little bit more so that I wasn't professional enough. I wasn't I was too loud. I needed to be smaller. I needed to be a lot of different things. There's just like this laundry list of things that I wasn't, but I needed if I was going to succeed. But I succeeded and I stumbled through and I was kept trying to make myself small and I was so uncomfortable. But I was trying to be corporate and I was trying to be professional. So I worked my way up through several different corporate jobs. I kind of got pigeonholed into social media because I was a young woman. But it turns out I'm okay with that because I loved it. And I've always been a strong writer. And so that kind of just led me through these different positions. So I've done a lot of different things in marketing. And eventually I got to a place where I was working in a position that I wasn't comfortable in, but it paid the bills. It was very corporate. And even though I worked for a lot of startups, it's still been fairly corporate. And a lot of personal trauma happened that year. My hometown burned down. My husband had a stroke. Wow. Yeah, a lot of really big, heavy stuff. We lost some family members. It was a lot. And this whole tiny box that I had tried to put myself in, but I hadn't successfully put myself in, but I was constantly trying. And every time I eked out of it, I punished myself and it was, oh, you know, you need to be in your box. It just broke. I couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, it broke in a big way, and like panic attacks in my car. You know, calling the doctor and like begging, like, what, give me medication, like what makes me fix this, what can put me back in this box, and I can deal and I can work this job. And my saving grace was actually that at the same time for my clients at that position I was in, I actually was experimenting on LinkedIn. This was 2020, and on top of the trauma of COVID, I was experimenting on LinkedIn, and literally the only thing I was doing, I was looking out for like, oh, I feel like something's happening on LinkedIn. Is this something we could exploit for, well, not exploit, but is something we could use for our clients? And my only rule, since it was just me, was I just had to entertain myself. And so I started leaving funny comments on like the Harvard Business Review. They've got these ridiculous photos, and they've got this one where it's all these hula hoops falling in front of red cliffs. And I left a comment that said something like, I want to see the original photo with like all those assistants throwing hula hoops as fast as they can. You know, it's something I thought was kind of like, I really do want to see that photo. And I got,
me too.
I got like 100 likes, and like people were all of a sudden, you know, reaching out and starting to connect with me. And I was like, oh, are people on LinkedIn starved for humor? So then I started, I started posting to entertain myself, and it was received really well. And what also was, it's, I was finally sharing a side of me that had been, I don't want to say punished in the corporate world, but it is that side that was told, no, you need to go back in the box. You need to do things this way. This is how young women in the workforce are. But I was inappropriate and I was irreverent and I was a little bit goofy and wild on LinkedIn, and people loved it. And eventually got to the point where not only did they love it and want to connect with me and get to know me, but they also wanted to hire me for that thing, that big part of my personality, the loudness, the inappropriateness, the unfiltered side that I'd been trying to suppress this whole time. People wanted to pay me money for it. That was when I decided, after a couple months of that, I decided to take the leap into freelancing with the skill that had carried me really through my career, which was my writing. It's been amazing. It's been the most freeing thing. It's been the best thing for my mental health. It's been the best thing for my health, for my relationships. It's been phenomenal.
I think it's funny that authenticity in the end usually does kind of lead the way, even when people tell you that you shouldn't be who you are, or shouldn't be away because, like you mentioned, you might be too much, or it might not be quote unquote like appropriate for what they think should fit into that coffin, that we end up being very like attracted as human beings to people who are very much authentic. And if you were doing what you were doing, but it wasn't actually you, it wouldn't feel the way it does to connect with you. It would feel like somebody was pushing into a mold that they don't actually fit into. I'm sure that's probably why you've built quite the following too, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even looking back at things that I did, like I had a customer service voice, everybody does, that ever works in customer service. And I had a sales voice because I did both. But if I look back, it was those clients that I let that slip a little bit. And I was maybe something they didn't expect, which me. and those relationships and those clients, we were rock solid. And, you know, like I was able to, you know, get through conflict or upsell, or, you know, I was most successful with those clients. So I can look back now and I can see like, oh, I was always successful because of who I was, but this like corporate thing that I was trying to do, it was just so painful and unnecessary. But I think people ask for it because it's safe. It's really, really safe. You don't, you know, if you go by the HR guidebook, if you never put yourself out there, you're never gonna be in an awkward situation that turns into an embarrassing story you tell at a party later. 90% of my life. So
you mentioned that you have, which I hadn't heard of before, synesthesia, which is like combined senses. Can you kind of talk about how that's impacted your outlook on life and your job?
Yeah. So synesthesia, so anesthesia is what you get, you know, when you get your colonoscopy or whatever, and you want no sensation, right? That's anesthesia. Synesthesia means the combined sensation, as you said. And so mine is, I mean, like, it's kind of cool. And I just found out about it in my 20s. I thought everybody thought this way. I thought this happened to everybody, but mine, as far as synesthesia goes, mine sounds like it's pretty run of the mill. But what you get is you get some people who can taste their words. So as they speak, they get a taste sensation, I guess. And some people can, they smell their thoughts. I don't know about that. Mine is, I think in color. And even within that, I sound pretty run of the mill, because if you look it up, you'll find musicians who each note is like a different color or different things. And that's really cool. For me, it's letters and numbers, and it's just, I break down my world into different colors and or color schemes. So when I meet somebody, so like Ashley, for example, is just a red name, just because of how the letters are in my mind, but your personality will impact it. So yours is actually red and purple at this point.
I so like that.
That's kind of, it's kind of interesting. And I don't have favorite colors. Like, people always go, when I tell them the color of their name, they're like, oh, is that good? I'm like, I don't know. It just is. Your
name is. Hey, that was my next question.
Yeah. No, there's no real rhyme or reason. I have a lot of reds. There's a lot of red hues and things. Apparently I skew red. And my name is the color that shifts the most, which is interesting. And I never thought about till people started asking me. But in terms of my job, I think it's what makes me a strong writer, and I think it's what makes me a strong ghostwriter. So when I approach a writing project, basically I just need to know what, so they, you always say, okay, what tone are we writing in? But once I know the tone, I write in that color. So it's always been easy for me, especially like, I remember back in high school when I knew the teacher and I knew what colors they liked. I mean, the first couple of papers I might get a B, but after that it was all A's and A pluses as far as writing assignments went, because as soon as I honed in what kind of tone they were looking for, I knew exactly what color to write for. So I remember I had a teacher, Mr. Farmer. If you wrote in orange and yellow, gold, but that means nothing to anybody else. You know, nobody, if you heard that as, oh, just write in orange and yellow, you'd be like, yeah, you're insane. But that's how it works. So now when I work with my ghostwriting clients, you know, I'll do an interview. We've got a transcript tool up, and I get them to monologue about what they're really passionate about within their industry or their service or whatever. And once I can get them to monologue, I can hear their tone and I can hear what color they're going to want to write in. And so it's speech pattern and it's the types of words they use and that sort of thing. And so then I can create something that flows exactly as they speak within their desired genre and industry.
I have to admit, like, I'm a little bit green with envy, but yeah, my cheesy pun, but I wish I could do that. I can't. Like, I know you've explained it well, but I can't imagine like actually feeling that and being able to do that. I didn't know that was even a thing that, yeah. Actually, Did you ever hear like when people, I don't know when it was going around, and I can't think of the name of the condition now, but there are people who don't have an inner monologue. And when I'm thinking, I like hear myself talking, and then other people don't. And I didn't know that. So I like live my whole life thinking that everybody had like little Jiminy Cricket in their mind all the time, kind of like talking to them. And then I found out that like people don't all have that. And it just kind of blew my mind.
Yeah. Well, this is how it came about. I was telling somebody, I was in the car with a bunch of friends, and I was telling them, I had this terrible nightmare the other night, and all my nightmares are in this color. And it's this weird, it's that mauve-y weird color, you know, I've talked about. It's like kind of a this is how I describe it. It's when the sun sets behind a storm cloud, like a thunderstorm. Uh-huh. So it's like that weird, creepy gray, pinky color. Oh, it used to make me cry. And my mother and my parents are like, as far as we know, nothing traumatic happened to you as a child during a thunderstorm sunset. But it's in my nightmares and whatever. And so I was telling them, I was like, but you know that nightmare color that everybody has? And all my friends were like, no, that's not a thing. And I'm like, no, that's a thing. And I kept like trying to explain it. They kept going, you're crazy. And then one of them had just watched a TED Talk, and he was like, oh, actually, no, I think you might have synesthesia. And then I watched the little video with them, and I was like, you don't see your fours as green? He was like, it's a number. And I'm like, yeah, so it's green. And then I started finding more synesthesia videos, and I started talking to people, and people were like, oh yeah, I see your four is orange. And logically I can understand what they're saying, but like deep in my soul, I'm like, shut your mouth. That's not, fours are green. They're not orange. Get out of here. So it's like two synesthesias. We can be like, oh yes, we have synesthesia. That's cool. But I've learned that we cannot discuss the individual colors. Like that's just asking for trouble.
Have you joined like a club? How have you found these people?
Just like YouTube or whatever. Every now and again, you know, I'll mention like, oh, I have synesthesia. And somebody will be like, oh, I have that too. And then I'm like, cool. Let's not talk about any of it. Like I like to hear like, oh, what kind? Because like I said, you can have like some people have taste, some people have smell. I'm sure there's a lot more variations of it. And even as I said, within color, it's very different. So I hear instruments and styles of music in different colors. And I organize my playlists very strictly based on the color scheme. I do not mix. I like people who can press shuffle all drive me insane. You can't have red music next to green and blue music next to yellow. You can't. It's anarchy. I refuse.
Can I ask you just in the future to keep in mind, like maybe taking a couple of screenshots of your playlist and like explaining it to people on LinkedIn? I think people would love that content.
I've done it once or twice.
Have you?
And I have a couple of playlists that I've named by the colors. So I've got dual tones playlist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that playlist. I'm like deep in that playlist right now.
I wanna tap into that and kind of like, I don't know. I know I'm not going to get it, but I'm just very interested in it. Kind of going back to, obviously you had different, you're outgoing and you said you're outspoken. Do you think that might be a thing that you just have always been like that? Like it's in your DNA, or do you think that you picked it up based on like different life experiences that you've had that have shaped you to be how you have become? I have heard for me that I came out like how I am, and I didn't have anything that shaped me to be like that. But I kind of feel like everybody might have like a story on how they get where they've been.
Well, I feel like leading with the awkward is a pretty, that's a coping mechanism. That's like years of having to deal with life. I think the nature element is that I love to laugh. I've always been a very smiley, laughy person. I love that. And so I'm quicker to laugh than I am to get angry or get upset in a lot of situations. It's just preferable. So I think that was a nature thing. I think the unfiltered side is a nurture. I kind of developed that. My older sister, I know when I was a kid, when we were kids, my older sister was really, really shy when she came into about like 7 or 8, and we're 3 years apart. And so I'm actually very shy, believe it or not. A lot of people like to assume I'm an extrovert, and honestly, I don't know, but I'm very shy. But my sister's shyness was not talking. And I, as the sidekick, developed this, like, that is so much worse. I would rather open my mouth and embarrass myself than sit here in silence with a stranger. Like, that's so bad. And so I kind of adapted it with that, between trying, you know, being the kid who had to go up to get the Fred Meyer cookie, you know, when your sister sends you up. So there's that element of it. And then also, I love to make people laugh. But nobody wants to be a bully. Well, people shouldn't want to be a bully. So it's self-deprecating humor is just like, it's right there. If you want to get the laugh, but you don't want to, you know, hurt people's feelings, self-deprecating humor is the obvious answer. The surprise laugh is my favorite thing. I feel like there's, as I said before, there's kind of this assumption of how young women should be. And I was never going to be demure and mysterious and elegant, as much as I would love to be demure and mysterious and elegant. I think that's a nature thing. It was never going to happen for me. But I am honest, and I am unfiltered, which is how my family is. And that surprises people sometimes, especially coming from, you know, young women. And the things that I'm okay with talking about. I also think nature-wise, my turnaround time for embarrassment is very, very small. Like, some people will share an embarrassing story from like a year ago. I need about at least a full business day, at most, you know, 2 weeks. There are very few things that I'm not willing to turn around and make fun of pretty much right away that were embarrassing to me. And I've had to learn that, like, not everybody is that way. There's some people who we have shared stories where it is equally embarrassing for both of us, and I'm in the story that I'm ready to share it. And they're like, I need you to give me a cool 6 months before you share that. And I don't know what that is, but that is, even in my family's like, why are you making fun of that now? Like, could you let it breathe? Let it scab. And I'm like, it's funny now. But so I don't know if that's a gene or what that is, but yeah, my turnaround time seems to be a little shorter.
I mean, it'd be entertaining to be in your family.
It is. And the funny thing is I think a lot of this comes from them. Honesty is a form of love in my family. And so they're very honest. They're very unfiltered in that. If you want to know the truth, my family will tell you, not in a harsh way, but amongst them, and I think it's their fault. I think that's the nurture part, but amongst them, they say, I'm the one who is born without a filter. And I'm like, I'm just doing what that's a concept that maybe is a nature thing. There's like, when people are like, oh, I want honesty, I'm like, oh, okay. And I just give it. And I've had to realize a learned thing for me is, people don't really mean that. And I would really like to normalize like gentle honesty, because everybody says, oh, be brutally honest. They don't mean that. They don't want that. I have learned that the hard way. Like, if I were being honest, you'd be like, oh, I don't care for that. If I'm being brutally honest, you look like a serial killer. Like, but they want a gentle honest of, oh, you know, you look better in this. That's what they wanted, but they said brutal honesty. Anyway, somebody didn't teach me that, or maybe that was a nature thing. I don't know, but I didn't figure that out till recently.
Have you ever had self-deprecating humor backfire on you?
Absolutely. Like, I have made some thoughtless comments involving medical issues that I did not think still existed. But I had a friend who she's a dental hygienist. And so she was taking like biology courses. And this is another thing that I didn't figure out. She makes jokes to me about some of these things she was learning. So she was learning about like rickets or something. And so she said, oh, you were walking around like you had rickets. And I thought that was so funny. I like cried laughing when she said it to me because I had been like sore after a run or something. And I was like, it was so funny. And so then I was out with somebody and I said that about myself. I was out in public and I said, oh, you know, I'm walking around like I got rickets. And then an elderly gentleman in front of me had rickets. And it was just like,
oh gosh.
Right? Like, it's so cringy, but also it's so obvious. Like, you don't make fun of medical things because people have medical things and it's the dumbest. Anyways, yeah. It's thoughtlessness like that gets me in trouble a lot of times. And it's like I said earlier, like when it involves me and another person, even if the punchline is me being the most embarrassing part of that story, I've had to learn that it's not just turnaround time. It's also somebody else's story too. It's not just mine to tell. And so yeah. I have to find... Yeah. And my husband gets the short end of that stick all the time. He's so patient and he's a good sport, but yeah, he's in all of my stories. So he gets looped in some way. And I don't know what contextually, you know, might be really embarrassing or has some added baggage to it that I have no idea about for these people I share these stories with. And so
we have that in common.
Good. That makes me feel better.
Yeah. My poor husband. He had to tell me, he thought, I don't know why, but a couple of weeks ago, he thought he could moonwalk. He just decided, though he had never watched himself do it, that he could, and he wanted me to film it. And I did, and it was comical to the point of like me wanting to beg him to put it online, because it would have been, everybody else would have like had tears of joy. But he was like, don't, and then he was like, and don't show it on LinkedIn either. Like LinkedIn was number two.
My husband started saying that. He's like, don't share that on LinkedIn. I'm like, oh gosh, I feel like I'm just nice about him on LinkedIn. And so now we have a system for that. But you do, you have to figure out, okay, what's my story to tell and what isn't. And so, yeah, but also the nature of self-deprecating humor, the worst way it backfires is, and the most common way is when somebody doesn't understand or it's not their type of humor. They don't appreciate it at all.
That would be happen to me a lot too.
Case, you've insulted yourself. Yep. So you've just insulted yourself and no one is laughing. So you've just insulted yourself. That's the only way it ends. And that's quite
I follow. Experience. Oh yeah. I've been humbled by my own verbiage quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it can backfire for sure.
On LinkedIn, there was a point when you were known for your pickle mascot outfit, and then you had vanished, and everybody on the platform was looking what happened to Michelle. Can you talk about what happened there? I think it would be kind of cool to tie that into the maybe backlash you might be getting from being openly Michelle, and like what might consequences people might expect could happen to them by doing that.
Yeah. So the pickle costume, so I'll give you a quick origin story. I have no special affinity for pickles. I like them well enough. I only like dill. Like, that's about it. I like them a regular amount. At one point, briefly, I don't take a good selfie. And so I decided I was just going to post all these goofy photos of me, and the guys either liked them or they didn't. And it worked out really well. I used it kind of as a filter. So my girlfriend and I had taken, we went to a costume shop, and the rule was we had to put on these embarrassing costumes and take photos of each other. And the other person chose the costume. So she chose a pickle costume. I popped it on, snapped it in the store. Great. I used that on my dating profile. And I told a coworker about that years later and how successful it was for me, how good of a filter it was. And she didn't believe it. And then I uploaded it to the company. This was when I was experimenting on LinkedIn and getting an audience. She's like, I bet you won't put it on LinkedIn. And I was like, girl, watch me. So I put it on LinkedIn and then I blew up. I got, you know, a couple thousand followers, you know, in the next couple months with people going, are you in a pickle? Is that a cucumber? What is that? And it was just kind of goofy and ridiculous. And I left it because people liked it. And because it was kind of like, if I can look this dumb and still build a following and make a living, you can too. And you don't look nearly as dumb as I do. So it's multi-purpose. But anyhow, LinkedIn eventually took it down. I think it got reported. I don't know. I never heard back. But they took it down. And the weirdest thing, they tell you in an email buried somewhere in your Gmail that, oh, by the way, we took your photo down for violating our rules. But I read the rules and it was a picture of me. It had my face. It's my likeness, you know, and I am not actually a pickle, nor am I saying I'm a pickle. I'm just a woman in a pickle suit. And 90% of people have understood that. So I wasn't violating their rules. So I kind of, you know, I reached out to the help, didn't hear anything back, but it had disappeared. Everybody who was looking at me couldn't see it, but I could log in and I still saw it. It was a whole thing. Anyways, long story short, I basically screenshotted the rules, published it, and I said, you know, hey, audience, do you think I'm violating it? Because my belief is social media, you agree to their terms. It's their world, it's their rules. And, you know, if I am in violation, you got to pay to play. So I got to change something to do it. But I just didn't think I was. So I figured, some free content while I figure this out. We'll see what people think. It blew up with people not even in my network who were coming in the comments and saying things like, if you want to do that on Instagram or Facebook, that's fine. But LinkedIn is a different platform. It's professional. And, you know, people were saying like, oh yeah, you deserve to take it down because you're not actually a pickle. I'm like, oh, okay. And just all sorts of things. And people were like, if you really care about pickles, just take a selfie with a pickle jar. I'm like, okay, I don't care about pickles that much. Hey, calm down. I'm not going to do that. yeah, it was pretty wild. And I had a lot of people come to my defense who were like, it's goofy, who cares? But it was her. And at the end of the day, I did a clap back because some people just like bugged me. I did let them get to me. There were a couple of people who called me like sour grapes or something that lived in my brain rent free. The sour grapes comment specifically. Well, I even know the guy's name still. I don't know why. It's like such a low comment, but it, yeah, I bugged me. But I did a clap back where I did a video where I was professional. And then I transitioned into a hot dog costume, which I'd done for my husband. And the thing is my freelancing took off after the pickle costume. People like the ridiculousness. They like that it's unprofessional. I stand out, you know? And if I stand out in a way that you don't like, don't follow. Like if you don't want pickles in your feed, it's a very easy answer. Don't follow. Block,
can you imagine if they would have like if LinkedIn would have actually gotten back to you with like any kind of a response, like what would it have been like, this cucumber has too much brine in it and it over pickled, like what, like because exactly, like, you did like you didn't violate any of their like guidelines, so I mean what would be the comeback anyway? I felt like that whole thing just got like blown out of proportion.
Well, people kept saying, yeah, well, in the comments were things like, well, if you wouldn't show up to work. And I was like, I have a professional headshot from my last company in a pickle suit. Like they paid for a professional headshot of me in the pickle. They specifically
like,
asked me.
I do show up like the pickle occasionally. Like,
and people were like, do you go to meetings that way? And I'm like, yes, accidentally and on purpose. I once was in a rush. I was like filming pickle content and then I had to get to a meeting and I was like, well, they're going to learn today. There's on the camera and don't see the pickle. So like it is who I am. Yeah. I wear a ridiculous pickle costume. I'm here for laughs, even if some of them are cheap. And some people didn't appreciate that, which is very fine because what I found they were doing was they were projecting how they wanted to use LinkedIn, or in some cases they were projecting their own insecurity onto what I was doing. Which something a little closer to home I've been able to recognize was something that originally my husband was doing. he loved my funny posts. He loved them. But then he'd sit there with them and he'd go, ooh, but this is your lead gen. Ooh, are you sure you want to take that stance? Are you sure you want to? And he would get kind of insecure about it because he wouldn't do that. And so I'd already had that realization with him and that conversation with him of, oh, you can't project that stuff on me. Like, I just, when I read this to you, you just tell me if you laughed or not, you know, I value your advice, but if you wouldn't post it, that doesn't mean I shouldn't. And that was something that these people were going on and projecting to me. They would never show up to a professional meeting as a financial advisor in a pickle suit. I wouldn't expect you to. You're a financial advisor. You have a very serious job. I am a freelance writer. I mean, that's just how the cookie crumbles. I get to be a lot more creative. I'm paid to be creative. I'm paid to be a little bit more out there. And I work for myself, so I've got to stand out.
I love that. It takes a little bit of the burden of you feeling like you need to meet other people's like criteria and feelings and whatnot. Yeah. Like, you shouldn't be doing that, but we all do that. We like put all that weight. You like carry all this weight like of other people's emotional baggage on that, and we shouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it does take a little bit, because when my husband, of course, whose opinion I value over everyone, you know, is my favorite human. When he says something, you know, I pay attention to it. But what I found was, if I would read the post to him before I published it, he'd question it and he'd be really nervous and he'd get very anxious about it sometimes, especially if it was like an out there post. But if I told him I'd published it and I told him it was performing and then I read it to him, he would be a lot calmer because it had already proved itself. So for a minute there, I could only read to him my already published stuff. But then now we're at a place where we've already had that conversation. But I've had to remove that because I would get anxious. If he was anxious about it, I was like, oh my gosh, and maybe I shouldn't. Oh my gosh, well, what about that post I did last week? But then I thought about it and, well, that post last week got me 2 leads.
Yeah.
And they're basically the same energy. So I need to get out of that headspace and remove myself from that. And it's the same thing with those people who, you know, hate the pickle suit. I can't really futz about with what they think.
You have compared people complaining about social media to the town square grumblers, which I love. I just think it's funny. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, when you went to the town square back in the day, and even still in some places today, you go to the plaza or the town square, it's a place of conversation. It's a place where people are sharing big ideas. And if you think that Socrates just like wasn't out on the street, you know, spewing all kinds of things, and people were walking by going like, damn hippie, or, you know, whatever the equivalent was back then, or, you know, dirty hobo in Socrates' case, you know, they absolutely were. And it's the same thing. And people were going, this isn't the place for it. You say that kind of thing in your home. Socrates didn't have a home, lived on the street, but whatever. But, you know, that it's that same energy of like, this isn't the place for it. Well, who says? Like, the social media aspect is for you to go and say your ideas. And there's an element of like shouting into the void, but there's in the town square as well. You're just shouting and hoping somebody might hear you. And maybe you get a little audience. And then you get that one guy who's like, this isn't the place for it.
That reminds me of it was called at my campus at University of Missouri. It was called Speaker Circle. And it was anybody could go there theoretically and just yell anything that they wanted to without like any kind of consequence. And there used to be an older guy who would go out there in his underwear and just kick a hacky sack a couple of times a week, even if it was -5. And people would walk by him, and there was occasionally a priest out there who would condemn him to hell and all kinds of different things. But, you know, you could walk by it, you could have a discussion with him, you could complain about it, which people did. But, you know, people got to have an outlet. And I don't know how much complaining about anything that anybody's talking about does any good anyway.
Humans have always been, we've always had ideas, and we've always wanted to express ourselves. And, you know, there's not, I think historically there hasn't been a ton of platforms in which we can do that other than public spaces. Social media isn't exactly a public space, again, because it's privately owned. but I really do feel it's very similar energy. And the people who, you know, are going there and knowingly going with, when you know that people are going to be there sharing their opinions, it's silly. It's like going into Central Park and then being mad that there's a, you know, guy playing bagpipes under the bridge. It's Central Park. If there's not a guy with a bagpipe, there's going to be a guy with an accordion, a guy with a hacky sack, somebody with a guitar. Like, it's Central Park. You're going to find some musician at some point, or, you know, anywhere. If you go to New Orleans and, you know, I think it's Jackson Square, there's artists on the fences. If you go every time and you're like, oh, these artists who are using this fence, you know, to display their art and sell it. Ooh, that just, oh, it grinds my gears. Stop going, man. Like, there's nothing that says that you're not allowed to go to be there. And we've always done that. We've always done this kind of thing in some kind of form. And there's always been grumblers. So it's, on one hand, it's frustrating. It's kind of silly. It's like, stop going if you don't like it. But then on the other, it's like, it is part of the experience. Like, just as much as you expect to see the artist, you expect to see a grumbler. So
let's get tactical. If there are people out there who have been told, like, over and over again that they're not professional enough, even though they might feel like that is where they're comfortable, like, what advice would you give them when it comes to looking for a job or just doing what they can at the job that they have?
Yeah, I don't recommend leading with the awkward for everybody. It's definitely for the... I won't say it's not for the faint of heart, because I don't know that you're more courageous or anything, but it's a personality thing. So I don't recommend the awkward and the ridiculous to everybody. What I do recommend is, if there's something you won't shut up about within your work, you know, I said, when I speak with my clients, I have them monologue to me. And it's not, I don't say, oh, start monologuing. I ask them questions, and when there's something that I can tell that they're just taking off on, I ask more questions within that realm until it gets to a point where I'm not asking questions anymore and they're just explaining and giving me this masterclass. And I feel like if, as long as you like some aspect of your career, maybe, you know, taxes isn't your calling and yet you're an accountant, but if there is something that you care about, if it's customer care or you know, if it's finding the right kind of accountant or, you know, whatever your industry is, if there's something about it that you could just rant on and on and on about, that's where I say, dig a little deeper and write to that. Cause that's what people want to hear it. And they want to hear it from you. And a piece that I always get caught up in is I always think, well, oh, the marketing stuff's already been done. I don't have anything to say in that space. And I have to remember what I tell anybody who I'd be like coaching or my clients, even when they say, oh, you know, my industry's been played out, but not by you. You've said it in a completely different way. You use different metaphors. You have a different context. Your road here has been different than, you know, these other people. And that's powerful and important and offers a connection. And if you speak to even 50 people and five of them like what you're saying and one of them hires you, that's one more than you had yesterday. And it only builds. As long as you can keep the momentum with your passion, I think that's what keeps the momentum, is your passion. I think you can write to that and speak to that. And then also, you know, I don't encourage donning food item costumes, and I don't think that everybody should be going out there sharing their most embarrassing stories. But it's fun. There's something fun about and different about two truths and a lie, which everybody credits to Ariel Lee. And that was totally me. I started that, by the way. But there's something fun to two truths and a lie. There's something fun to the unexpected, to asking questions that nobody's asking. Like, everybody asks, oh, what's your New Year's resolution? Nobody asks, what's your fifth favorite lizard? Nobody asks that. And we need to know. You know, so like, it's okay to be different, and it's okay to test it too. That's a big thing, is stop thinking, oh, each one's got to land. Each piece of my content has to land. It's all testing.
Okay, I like to end the show by asking everybody to debunk an unpopular opinion, which just means anything that people are claiming to be unpopular in your feed that is kind of just a cover up, not that unpopular, kind of a safe bet. Everybody agrees with you anyway. Do you have anything that might come to mind on that end?
That so that somebody in your feed is saying, oh, this unpopular,
it's unpopular opinion, and then nothing. Like,
I think I've given this so much thought since you, and I don't feel like I came up with an adequate one. I think I don't know that people say it's like an unpopular opinion, but the whole, oh, this cold outreach person, you know, like this is terrible. Look at how bad they did. Like, yeah, we know, like everybody's getting them. I don't know. I don't love when we put people on blast, even if they're like sexist or inappropriate. It's like, yeah, everybody's getting them. I don't know. What I like is if somebody comes out with like an unpopular opinion, this trend is crap, or stop cold DMing this way, or whatever it is. I am only interested if you have a creative solution.
Oh.
So my favorite that I've done so far is I asked a cold DMer what Disney movie was a part of their sexual awakening, and I never heard back from them again.
I can't imagine why.
And I was like, mine was Robin Hood.
Just nothing. I will keep that in mind.
Read more about that. Like, what uncomfortable story did you, you know? And I've published a couple of those. I think, and I've seen a couple where people are like, "This was my rando response to a cold DM that was wildly inappropriate." And I'm like, "That show the people how to silence the cold DMers in a creative way." That I love. But just the popping it up and going, "Unpopular opinion. I know sales is hard, but there's a better way to do this." It's like, eh.
Yeah, played. No, played. No, like I like the idea of like including, like you said, a creative solution though. I don't think a lot of people are doing that. They complain and they out people and they show what not to do, and then they don't have anything to do about it after. It's just kind of like a into the wind, like who might agree with me, and then nothing will come of it. But I like your idea about that.
I'll add the creators who go unpopular opinion, I hate insert trend. So if it's the spacing was getting a lot of heat for a minute, or people saying, oh, I hate PS when you had PS, or I hate when you add a question at the end. And just like all of these trend hating, unpopular opinion, but this trend is crap. It's like, okay, but trends are trends because they work. And as a creator, maybe you don't have a responsibility, but I feel like you should have like this thought process that the people who are reading your content are going to be informed or influenced by it. And if they had something in their drafts with a trend they thought might work, and you just went out and blasted it without a creative solution, now there's one other person who's feeling really self-conscious about publishing content. You know, and like I said, I don't know if you have a responsibility to them. That might be a little far, but I feel like you should be thoughtful of it at least. And I hate when people make a space less friendly. And I think that makes spaces less friendly to create.
So. I like that outlook. I haven't heard anybody explain it like that, but I like it. Where can people go if they want to follow you or find out more about you?
I believe it's linkedin.com/Michelle Hiranaka or something like that. But if you look up Michelle Hiranaka, that's Michelle with one L, and Hiranaka is Hironaka. It's Japanese and phonetic. If you look that up on LinkedIn, I'm the lady in the pickle costume.
And we should be able to identify you quickly. Do you have anywhere else people can go? Or is that your main hub?
Michael Eckstein made you ask that question to me. I haven't done my website yet. No, there is no other place right now.
Well, that's completely fine. If you're not already following Michelle, she is one of my favorite follows on LinkedIn. She has been entertaining me and making me laugh for about, I think, 18 months I've been following you now. And I am happy to have her in my feed, and you should be too. If she isn't already, go ahead and hit the follow on Michelle's page. Michelle, thank you for being on my show today.
Thank you so much, Ashley. This was a lot of fun.
I'm glad that you had fun, and I hope that you come back again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Unpopular Opinion. This episode was produced by Audience Ops, a content-led growth agency. If you're looking for help launching a podcast, Audience Ops handles all the legwork, so you can focus on providing the subject matter expertise. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow Ashley's show on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube.